So it ends up that when Keith Trufer interviewed Paul Godwin, and Bob and I were there, and he deposed him, and Paul Godwin didn't know what reports we had, police reports or anything with at the time. He was what, I guess it was 2 years after, it was in 2008, not quite 2009. And so Paul Godwin, and it was really strange. I'm just saying it was strange because my son, like I have this picture that is a really, it's, my son was handsome. He was beautiful inside and out. He was. And I, one of my favorite pictures of him is a picture that I post a lot. I post a lot of pictures of him throughout his life, but he's wearing like a blue and white striped polo shirt. He loved that shirt. Yeah. And before he got his haircut, he had that sort of long hair, like the Ashton Kutcher kind of thing. Yeah. But then he got his haircut, and I loved his haircut. I loved it. I thought, oh my gosh, Joe, you look so handsome. And he was kind and loving to everybody, but he wasn't like a person that was stuck up or something. But yeah. My baby was crushed to death.
I know you lost your son, but you have to keep fighting for him. Because law enforcement certainly isn't. To them, he's just another statistic. It's all about placing life in perspective.
Oh, I know. But at least, like I'm saying, the medical examiners, they did study everything. They did. Dr. Ali even went out there like and got in the machine. And he knew Joseph had no broken bones below his neck. He knew. They paid attention. And then, like I'm saying, when Paul Godwin was deposed by Keith Trufer, it says in the police report, pushing.
This is Mark. Since 2015, I have written a weekly column about unsolved homicides and true crime for the Claremont Sun newspaper located in Ohio. Before discussing this week's episode, I would like to ask for your support. I am looking for listeners to help support the podcast by buying me one $5 cup of coffee every month. This will help cover expenses that go with producing a successful podcast. If you can help, please visit catchmykiller.com and click on the donate link or on the buy me a coffee link. And if you cannot donate to the podcast, you can still help by sharing these stories with your friends and families through word of mouth and social media. And that's enough of the coffee business. This week's story involves the conclusion of the homicide of a 19-year-old Maryland man named Joseph Miranda. Please be sure to listen to parts 1 and 2 prior to this episode. By this part of the story, Adrian Miranda has been fighting for over a decade to get justice for her son Joseph. He was murdered in 2006. Although the killer has been identified, he has never been prosecuted. Baltimore County Prosecutor Schellenberger has refused to prosecute Joseph's killer. Adrienne has vowed to fight for her son. She began her own investigation. Eventually, she learned that a state medical examiner named Dr. Ollie had received additional evidence and ruled the case a homicide. He contacted law enforcement and wrote, "As the death was caused by the action of another person, the manner of death is best reclassified as a homicide." However, the state's attorney for Baltimore County, Scott Schellenberger, said there will be no further inquiry, no arrest, no grand jury, no trial, no criminal charges in Joseph's death. This was after he received notice of the case being reclassified as a homicide. Adrienne has told me she will fight for justice for Joseph for the rest of her life. And now on with the story of Joseph Miranda as told by his mother, Adrienne. This is part 3 of 3 in the conclusion of this story.
I did want to just finish this. When I went to Keith Franz, when it was during the winter, he was the one that was at the closing meeting with the Maryland State Police, saw everything that happened. And he comes out, Keith Franz, I'll get to that, what the driver says. But Keith Franz comes out and he says, "Adrian, put your documents away." Because I was saying I was going to sue the state police. I was going to sue them. And I was going to sue them for their negligence, for their perjury, for their obstruction of justice. And he said, "Put your documents away. You cannot sue the state police." I had talked to His name was Michael Silvestri, who was with me on the case, who believed everything. He was a reporter. But he said to me, I remember at one time, Adrian, you can sue anybody, you darn please. Don't let anybody ever tell you you can't sue anybody. You can sue anybody. And I know that's a fact. You can sue anybody. Your case should have merit. But I certainly thought I had a lot of merit against the state police and against Moshe. But anyway, he comes out and says, Keith Franz comes out after his meeting and says, Adrian, he says, now, Adrian, you'll get $1.5 million, $2 million with Bob, but you cannot sue the state police. I looked at Bob like wide-eyed. I want you to think about what I just said, Adrian. Put your documents away. He said, Scott Schellenberger will probably take on the case himself, but you cannot sue the Maryland State Police. So you have to adhere to that. And he grabbed our coats. He like rushed us out to the elevator. And we were just like, unbelievable. Unbelievable. And the next week, I sued the Maryland State Police. No money. I felt like they can take their whatever amount of money, any amount of money, and shove it up their butts.
So what happened after you sued the police?
Dismissed, because they all have immunity. And then we also sued for intentional infliction of emotional distress, because that's a law in Maryland. Mm-hmm. And Bob and I were made sick to death, physically, emotionally sick to death with what they did and how they've just beat us down every step of the way. I had a bleeding ulcer. I was sick to my stomach. I had to have all kinds of endoscopies, colonoscopies, had a bleeding ulcer, was sick. Bob could hardly walk. He had got like this neuropathy in his feet. We were sick. We were made physically and emotionally sick. And with that, we ended up going to court before this judge, Dana Levitz, and it was the craziest trial, or whatever you want to call it, that I've ever seen. And it was me before this judge, and I don't know, maybe 30 people in the courtroom. And on the left, against me, were about 7 attorneys, all different 7, because I sued the Maryland State Police and Moshe. And all 7 from the Attorney General's office, representing different police, because they were from different districts. The Maryland State Police had different lawyers representing them. They all worked for the Attorney General. So it was me against 7 or 8 of them. And they basically said nothing. I talked. They didn't really say anything. And I remember the judge said to me, and I was trying to say mostly about how sick Bob and I were and had been made, because this was intentional infliction of emotional distress. And he said to me, and I got into sort of what had happened, how the police treated us, how they committed perjury, how they lied to us, the misconduct, the obstruction of justice, all of it. And I backed it up, you know, with facts and everything. And he said to me, Miss Miranda, I don't question one thing you say. He said, in fact, I know it's true. In fact, I know it is. You can't sue. And he kept saying that intentional infliction of emotional distress isn't a law in Maryland. And I was like, it isn't? I said, according to the treasurer, Nancy Kopp, it is. According to her website, it is. He said, well, it isn't. And he said, and I know as far as the police could be driving in their car with steering with their knees, eating donuts, waving their hands out the window, blasting a radio or whatever. It's all fine. Police can do that. I have his transcript. That's what he said. They can do whatever they want. The immunity laws have to be changed. They have got to be changed. They're like, the immunity laws give police a green light to do an act in any way they choose without ever being held accountable. Yeah. It leaves victims and their families with no recourse whatsoever. Those laws are what's like embedded and at the core of the corruption in law enforcement across our country.
You have certainly lived it.
I've lived it. Yes, I have lived it. And what I'm saying is, and Paul Godwin, he's married now. He has three children. He lives right up there in Hampstead, only 5 minutes away from Outside Unlimited. And he was deposed also. We deposed all of them. I got Keith Trufer, another attorney that I end up getting because I ended up getting away from Keith Franz. And people were knowing about the case. And like I said, it was a couple times in the Baltimore Sun, which is a major newspaper here. It was front page story. Channel 11, Channel 2, Fox 45. They all came and interviewed me. I have all the CDs. I have everything. When we deposed, I remember one day, this was at my son's gravesite, and this wasn't that long after he was killed, but we all took roses, beautiful roses. I took roses all the time, and then friends even took roses and beautiful, beautiful flowers and all. And I remember I went one day, and all the roses, like the heads, the roses and all were cut off. Like the heads, the flowers were all cut off. And I was crying. And then my nephew, he came, he saw it. And it was horrible. I felt like this desecration. We own that plot there. And I remember I called the police and this trooper came and he said, yeah, this isn't deer. These were cut off. There's no question. And he took a report and I would a lot of times take a blanket and my Bible and just sit there and just pray and talk to my son. And because Delaney Valley is it is a beautiful cemetery. They have markers. They don't have the big tombstones. They have markers and it's really pretty. They have a pond, a real pretty pond. And they have different like statues like the La Pietà and different stations of the cross and stuff. It is a beautiful cemetery. And even in the wintertime, children ice skate on the pond. I like the way they did it. Some people even run like their exercise and stuff around the lake and different things. But anyway, and I got to know the people that run the cemetery and I do know them and I know the people that have taken care of like when Michael died and my dad and then Joseph and Lisa and all. They're very nice people. They really are. They're wonderful. And Lisa, like the one girl there, she stands behind me completely like she does now. And she believes Joseph Graves was desecrated and all that for sure. But anyway, I remember, and this was just an unusual happening, but I remember when I was driving this one morning, and the cemetery is only, I don't know, 8 minutes from my house, not far at all. As I was driving on East Ridge Road, before you turn, like to go into the cemetery, I saw a bobcat in somebody's driveway, and it was a G873. It was just strange. I remember I stopped like a minute, and I just got out and looked at it, and I said, yeah, this is one of those. Same undercarriage, same model. It just seemed odd. Do you know what I mean? That here I am. But anyway, I see that I'm getting to Padonia Road where you either turn right or you turn left. If you turn left, you get to York Road. If you turn right, you go up a little ways and you go into the cemetery. I saw that I was almost on E on my gas tank. And I said to myself, gosh, Adrian, I said, you maybe should go and get gas before you go into the cemetery because after leaving, you might be upset. You probably will be upset. And you may forget to get gas and run out of gas on the way home. So I said, go left and go and get gas. So I went to the corner, you know, of York Road and Padonia Road. And there was, I think it's a BP or an Exxon station or something. But I pulled in there. I pull in and next to one of the gas pumps and I get out to put my credit card in and I open my gas tank. And on the other side of the two pumps, I hear a voice saying, is that her? And I look over, I just look vaguely, and I realize standing there is Paul Godwin and Antonio Rubio. What are the odds of that? And when we finished with Judge Dana Levitz, after he said, I know it's all true. In fact, I know it is, whatever. He said, if you want to appeal, because we're going to dismiss the case, but if you want to appeal, you can appeal to the Court of Special Appeals. And so he dismissed my case. And then with the Court of Special Appeals, you have to write a brief and a record extract. And a brief is 35 pages long, and a record extract is all the exhibits that you put together to support your brief. Okay? I'm not a lawyer. I don't ever want to be a lawyer. But I went to LexisNexis. I went to the law library, and I put together a brief and a record extract. It was done exactly verbatim. I made 12 copies of it. I was up all night at Kinko's putting these binders together, getting them to where they had to go, all these copies and everything. And typically, the three-judge panel goes to bring you in for a hearing when you write a brief and a record extract to at least hear you. They didn't even do that. They just wrote me a letter like 3 weeks later and again just said, your case is dismissed. They have immunity. And I have the brief and record extract right here. And I ended up going with Keith Trufer because, like I said, I was trying to find an attorney who, I don't know, somehow would help me with the case or take depositions or do something because I knew the criminal system wasn't going to help me. Scott Schellenberger wasn't going to do anything. The medical examiners had come through, for sure. They're scientists. They're experts. They're qualified. Scott Schellenberger's not a doctor. He's not a scientist. And I've seen different articles where he writes about how he relies on the medical examiners, how he wouldn't even have a basis for his cases without them. Yet with us, he completely ignores the medical examiners, their facts, their science, their physics, their forensics, their evidence. He just ignores it and goes against them. Homicide by an assault is not a crime. What? So,
I know laws vary, but I thought homicide by assault at least qualified as a felony. Therefore, it's a prosecutable offense.
People look at me and go, what? In whose world is it not a crime? What? An assault alone is a crime to the point of death? But anyway, this Keith Trufer, I remember when I was at my son's grave site, I remember I prayed and I was crying and I said, Joseph, I said, here, Mama, sweetheart, here, Mama. I said, oh, Lord, I said, can you just bring me one good attorney who can help me, justice for my child? And I said, Joseph, I said, show Mommy you hear me. Put a rainbow in the sky today. And I just sat there for half an hour and I prayed and I picked up my Bible and my blanket. And I drove home. And before I turned into my courtyard, there was a rainbow in the sky. Mommy knows you hear me, Joe. Mommy knows, Joseph. And then my light was blinking on my phone. My red light was blinking on my phone. I had a message. And I listened to it. And it was an attorney. And he said, hello. He said, calling for Adrian Miranda. And he said, Adrian, he said, my name is Keith Trufer. He said, and I want to help you. I want to help you with your son's case. And as he said, I was referred by Jared Emig. He said, and I had remembered his name because he was a really nice man. And Keith left his number and said for me to call him as soon as I could. And I remember Jared Emig because he was a man that at one time wanted to help me, but he said that he was so sorry he couldn't because there was a conflict of interest. And I know that can happen. He got in touch with Keith eventually, I guess, and said, Keith, help her. Try to help her, and I think you can. And so I then thanked Keith, and Bob and I went and met with Keith Trufer, and he did the depositions. He took the depositions of all of them, everybody. And he deposed Joe Medved. He does say he got inside the yellow crime scene tape with a broom for almost 3 hours, like as if it's okay. It's so weird. It's so, so sick and weird. So it ends up that when Keith Trufer interviewed Paul Godwin, and Bob and I were there, and he deposed him, and Paul Godwin didn't know what reports we had, police reports or anything at the time. He was I guess it was 2 years after. It was in 2008, not quite 2009. And so Paul Godwin, and it was really strange. I'm just saying it was strange because my son, like I have this picture that is a really It's my son was handsome. He was beautiful inside and out. He was. And one of my favorite pictures of him is a picture that I post a lot. I post a lot of pictures of him throughout his life. But he's wearing like a blue and white striped polo shirt. He loved that shirt.
Yeah.
And before he got his haircut, he had that sort of long hair like the Ashton Kutcher kind of thing.
Yeah.
But then he got his haircut, and I loved his haircut. I loved it. I thought, oh my gosh, Joe, you look so handsome. And he was kind and loving to everybody, but he wasn't like a person that was stuck up or something. But my baby was crushed to death.
I know you lost your son, but you have to keep fighting for him, because law enforcement certainly isn't. To them, he's just another statistic. It's all about placing life in perspective.
Oh, I know. But at least, like I'm saying, the medical examiners, they did study everything. They did. Dr. Ali even went out there and got in the machine. And he knew Joseph had no broken bones below his neck. He knew. They paid attention. And then, like I'm saying, when Paul Godwin was deposed by Keith Truffer, it says in the police report, pushing. It does say there was, like, Paul Godwin didn't know what reports we had or didn't have. And that he got irritated. And so my attorney says, after he introduces himself and his age, he went to Franklin High School. We asked him these questions. He's dating a girl. But what was weird, the reason why I was telling you about the striped shirt and the haircut and all that, what was just so weird was Paul Godwin had gotten his haircut. I swear his haircut was like the same cut as Joseph's. He was wearing a blue striped polo shirt and khakis. It was just weird. It was like the same exact clothes like my son wore, and he had no remorse whatsoever. He laughed at times. He had no remorse. And when Keith said to him, after he gave background answers to Keith's questions, he said, "Tell me about this pushing, Mr. Godwin. Tell me about pushing." He goes, "Pushing?" He says, "There wasn't any pushing." And my attorney, Keith Trooper, says, "Yes, there was." He says, "It's right here in the police report." And he says, "Oh, the police got it wrong. I gave Joe the 1-2. And he puts his fists up like a 1-2, like a boxing motion. And my attorney said, "Oh, you gave Joe the 1-2. He said, "Like you're showing me that of a boxing motion." Knocked him, punched him. He says, "Yeah, that's right." And so Keith says, "What did Joe do?" He said, "Nothing." Joe did nothing because Joe was dead. All I'm trying to say is if somebody gave my son the 1-2 or just started with him, Joe would take up for himself.
It's my guess he knocked your son out. Joe wasn't expecting to be punched, so he didn't put his hands up to defend himself.
He probably did. He knew that machine was coming back. Maybe Joseph's head hit part of the metal. I don't know. Or he whacked him so hard or punched him so hard that he did knock him cold.
Yeah,
but he meant to. And my son, in the autopsy report, my son's left eye is like bruised. It's like a bruise around his left eye. But Dr. Ali just said, it does seem like Joe had a black eye. He said, but it's hard to say that for sure because the injuries are so severe.
The injury could have also came from the bobcat. I'm guessing the medical examiner isn't sure whether the eye damage came from either the bobcat or a punch to the face.
Right, because my son was flat on the ground. His right cheek, like he fell with his right cheek against the road. His right cheek was against the road. And when it backed up, that left rear tire went over the top of his head, face, and neck and landed behind his left arm. It definitely backed up over him. There's no question. Joe was already on the ground. And Paul Godwin is the one that sent him to the ground. And he knew the bobcat was coming back. He knew the next move was reverse. And see, what the driver says, when you look at the driver's report, Antonio Rubio, he says that he saw Joe. He called Joe Jose. He saw Joe, like Joe flagged him down, like you're supposed to. You know, like, in other words, Antonio Rubio had dumped a bucket and brought the bucket down and was stopped. And Joe saw, as Joe approached, that Antonio Rubio was stopped. He made eye contact with him and waved Antonio down. You know what I mean? And Antonio looked at Joe, he called him Jose, and knew that Joe was getting ready to approach. Okay? So he knew that Joe wanted to say something to him. So Antonio says he leaned out and Joe leaned in, and they were talking a little high because the engine was running, just so you could hear each other. And he said, Joe said, he called him Tono, they'll call him Tono, for Antonio Rubio. I said, Tono, I need to use the Bobcat to load 20 trees, because that's what Eric Magala had told Joseph he needed to do, to load, get the Bobcat to load 20 trees. So in the report, Antonio says, okay, Jose, can I just load one more bucket? And Joseph said, sure. And these were two laborers. Not that it matters. Joe was a foreman, but he was on the commercial side. And here you got two laborers on the residential side. And it wasn't that Joe, it wasn't anything like Joe's like throwing his weight around. It's nothing like that. It's just that his supervisor was telling him, they're just loading dirt. Like, we need to load 20 trees for the school. It's a more important job. And he saw that they loaded pretty much dirt already. And then Antonio, the driver, says, I watched Jose walk past the left side of the cage, because there's like cages on the sides of the Bobcat. I watched Joe walk past the left side of the cage to where Paul Godwin was standing to wait, you know, just to wait. And he says, I waited a minute, and then I began to back up. He said, I turned the wheels slightly left, slightly the steering left, and backed up about 3 or 4 feet, and I stopped, because that's what he typically does, to straighten it before he goes forward again. He said, and I backed it up about 3 or 4 feet, and I stopped. And then, suddenly, Paul Godwin was at the left front of the Bobcat with his hand across his neck, telling me to stop, like motioning him to stop. He said, and I looked down and saw a pool of blood. And he jumped out and cried and begged for a priest and screamed. And Paul Godwin went into the office and said, Joe Miranda's dead. He killed my son. And then when later in the deposition, Keith Trooper's asking Paul Godwin some more questions, asking him again, like, what does... And he did ask him about a backup alarm, and Paul Godwin just answers, I don't recall it. So you could take that as either he doesn't recall a backup alarm beeping, or he just doesn't recall it at all. There wasn't a backup alarm. You used to see their trucks around here all the time outside Unlimited. The white trucks with the green tree, that was their logo. You used to see them everywhere. After my son died, you didn't see them anymore. And they said when Joseph was killed, there was like a mass exodus. Like over 100 people left, just quit. And now, as of about 4 years ago, Outside Unlimited has been shut down. As of about 4 years ago, I don't know where Joe Medved is. I don't know if he still has that mansion. He probably still has the Big Stone Mansion. I'm sure it's a couple million dollars at least. He probably still lives there. But if you try to look him up or find him, you can't find him. He's got parents, Mary Ellen Medved, and she was a big-time realtor. They have property all over the country. 6 weeks before my son was killed, came home one evening, and, you know, I was getting dinner together for us, and he had taken a shower, you know, came back downstairs, sitting at the corner of the table, and he just had his, like, forehead leaned on his forearm, and he was just kind of, I knew something was bothering him. And I said, Joe, what's wrong? He wouldn't answer me. He didn't answer me or look up or anything. He just kept his head like on his arm. He was distraught. And he said, Mom, Outside Unlimited does bad things. And I said, Joe, what do you mean? He just put his head back down. He heard something or found out something. You're telling me Outside Unlimited does bad things. And my son wasn't kidding around. He found out something. And so I went and got the portable phone. And I took it to him. I said, Joe, you need to call and resign. Just call and resign. And he said, Mom, he said, look, he said, I don't want you to worry. I'll be okay. He said, I'm only going to collect another paycheck or two, and I'm out of there. I'm going back to school. I want to become a landscaping architect. Yeah. He said, don't worry. I'll be fine. And then, 6 weeks later, he was dead. He was going to resign. But I think that he just, maybe he felt... He definitely was going to go back to school. We had it planned. He had already been enrolled, actually. So we knew we were just going to pick up where we left off. And he felt like he had learned. He had gotten two promotions. It made him a foreman. He wanted to become a landscaping architect. He wanted to get his degree. But what I'm saying is that I don't know what he found out. I don't know if he overheard something. I don't know if they asked Joseph to do something. I don't know what. I don't really know what. Joseph, first of all, wouldn't. I'm sure, like, if they did, Joseph wouldn't do something. Yeah. Or I think maybe Joseph overheard something. But he wasn't even telling me. But I can't sit here and tell you Joseph's death was premeditated. I can't tell you that. But what I can tell you is Paul Godwin saw the opportunity to kill my son, and he took it. And my son, I will even tell you this. I'm a detailed person, and I'm not going to miss a detail. I'm not. And this is my child. This is my heart, my life. I think my son was just drinking a soda. He wasn't fighting anybody.
He wasn't expecting to be sucker punched.
No. And I think when he bashed him, when he got him, it flung out of his hand. The soda flung out of his hand. Joseph went down, and he was crushed to death. And many attorneys have said to me, Adrian, it's no different than throwing someone into a moving train. It's no different. Your son was murdered. And it isn't any different. But for, like they say, but for a lot. It's like a legal term. But for Paul Godwin, Joseph Miranda is alive. In other words, without Paul Godwin, if you remove Paul Godwin, my son is alive today.
I'm going to ask you a last question here. I want to address people that are listening to this. For anybody that's listening to this, what are you trying to accomplish with your son? I know justice, but tell me, in all the pursuits, all this that you are doing, getting the lawyers, doing the research, what is your ultimate goal?
First and foremost, I do want justice for my son. My son's voice, like I said, needs to be heard. My son, they are blaming the victim, and my son didn't take his own life and jump up on any tire, and the truth needs to be told, the truth and justice. And that is my goal, number one, for justice and truth to be served. Secondly, as far as what I've learned and been through this journey of almost 14 years, is that the immunity laws that protect law enforcement, prosecutors, all these agencies, the immunity laws have to either be abolished or reformed. They're antiquated, they're totally against the American people, and they're completely planted, unfair. And I believe the immunity laws are like a breeding ground that almost condone corruption. It allows them to condone corruption because the police, the investigators, prosecutors, they're never held accountable. They're never held accountable for anything. And no one is above the law. Don't we all say that no one is above the law? Evidently, the immunity laws give them the right to abuse their power.
And that concludes the story of Joseph Miranda. This was the three-part story of Joseph Miranda, a 19-year-old man who was brutally murdered by a coworker. His mother, Adrienne, still fights on to get justice for her son who was murdered over 14 years ago. Although Joseph was murdered and the killer's identity was known, no one has ever been prosecuted. If you would like to know more about Joseph's story, please visit pleasedoyourjob.com. I would also like to ask you to sign the petition on the page to get justice for Joseph. I will also provide this information in the story notes. And if you are a parent, law enforcement official, friend, or relative seeking justice for an unsolved homicide case, please visit my website and complete the contact form or contact me through Facebook. Thank you for listening.